Good evening, everybody. It is wonderful to see you. I've got stuff here, so it's going to take me a second. There we go. God is good.
All the time.
God is good. Hey, welcome to week 5 of an 8-week series called Milk and Honey, Sand and Rock. We are moving from Genesis through 2 Chronicles. My goal is to equip you to understand the Old Testament, all right? That's it. I want the Old Testament to come alive for you as we enter into it collectively in January. Why? Because 2/3 of the Bible is the Old Testament. Why would God give us the Old Testament if he wanted us to avoid it? Why would he give it to us if there wasn't something in it? And yet, I'm going to tell you, I think it takes a little bit of effort to embrace the Old Testament. So let's begin by reviewing the world of the Old Testament. Here we are in St. Louis, and we are going to fly all the way across the Atlantic, across the Mediterranean. We are going to park in the Persian Gulf. That is sort of the that part of the Fertile Crescent, the city of Abram. Probably the most important city in the world in the time of Abram. We're going to head on up and over around the Fertile Crescent. Babylon, who destroyed Jerusalem at the beginning of the Nehemiah narrative. We're going to head up to Haran, which is not a major city today. Well, we got Nineveh first, and then we're going to head up to Haran. Not a major city today, but there's enough on top of it, they can't really excavate it, so we don't know as much about it as we could. Then we're going to head on up and over. We're going to head down the Mediterranean coast, Damascus in Syria, probably along with Jericho, one of the two oldest cities in the world, Sea of Galilee. Now we're down to Jerusalem, also called Salem, also called Jebus in the Old Testament. Then we're going to head to Egypt, to Cairo, and the area around here, and I'll talk to you a little bit about the complexities of that, and then we're going to head to the Red Sea. That kind of gives us a sea to shining sea look at the world of the Old Testament. Now, what I'm wanting to do is start getting you a pathway through the Old Testament. So it begins with creation. God said, and there was. God created the heavens and the earth, and it was good. So the Old Testament begins with a pristine and a perfect creation. There is no sin in the world. Everything is beautiful. The relationships are as God intended them to be. First two chapters of Genesis, I think, are the most incredible glimpse we get in the whole Bible, because we get a look at what the world looks like without sin. It's an incredible thing. Then we get to the fall. God said to Adam and Eve, if you all will just obey me, this is yours forever. They couldn't do it. They disobey God. They throw off the rule and reign of God. They shake their finger in the face of God and say, who are you to tell me what to do? And folks, people have been doing it ever since. Who are you, God, to tell me what to do? That's why people reject the Bible today. They read the Bible, they see God's way of living, and they shake their finger in the face of God and say, who are you to tell me how to live? There is rebellion in the fall. And then things get worse. Adam and Eve get thrown out of the Garden of Eden. It is guarded by flaming swords that spin, which kind of makes me think of like a video game in the early 90s, just kind of, you know, kind of thing. They can't go in. And then things get bad. We've got a flood that destroys everything in the world. We've got a story called the Tower of Babel, where God sort of buys time for humanity because humanity is on a path to destruction. And then all of a sudden, we hit this dry spell in salvation history, which is just the history of God and human interaction. We hit this dry spell, and from the narrative, it doesn't appear there's anyone in the world who believes in God. It seems the maker of the earth has been completely forgotten by everyone. And then God shows up one day, taps on the shoulder of a guy named Abram from Ur, and all of a sudden this thing kind of jump starts again. Well, God makes a covenant, and then we move to our next narrative. And we generally call it the Exodus. It's going to be followed by the Judges next week. The following week, we'll look at the Kings. Then the seventh week, or the final week of this, we will look at the cross and how the cross provides the narrative for the whole of the Old Testament. So, Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob is also named Israel. So if you ever wonder where the name Israel comes from, it's one of the names they call Jacob. And Jacob named his 11th son Joseph. His 11th son, Joseph. His 11th son by his favorite wife, which is complex, but it is his oldest son by his favorite wife who happens to be his 11th son. So the chances of Joseph being the patriarch in the tribe of Jacob are next to zero. It would be like if you're the 11th child in line for a monarchy. I mean, a lot of really bad things are going to have to happen to a lot of people for you to ever get the nod. However, Joseph is the apple of his father's eye, which caused jealousy among his older brothers. Joseph is not the humble sort. And in fact, he's sort of an annoying kid. You guys ever know anybody that was an annoying kid? Maybe you were an annoying kid. But Joseph did stuff like this. He'd get all his brothers around, all 11 of his brothers. He'd say, "Guys, I got great news. I just had this dream. I'm standing in the middle, and you guys are all around me, and you all bow down to me. Isn't that awesome?" And finally, he just gets on his brother's last nerve. And they fake his death, and they sold him to traitors headed for Egypt. Through manic swings of fortune and misfortune, Joseph remains faithful to God. Joseph eventually rose to second in command in all of Egypt. And then around 1800 BC, a seven-year famine buckles the knees of the Fertile Crescent. Thanks to Joseph's leadership and obeying a ping dream from God, Egypt's prepared. While everybody else is starving, Egypt has stored up crops. Egypt is making a fortune while the rest of the Fertile Crescent is dying. To save themselves from starvation, the brothers go down to Egypt. Joseph recognizes them. Of course, they wouldn't recognize him. He is eventually reconciled with his brothers and eventually reunited with his father. It's a pretty incredible story. You'll love reading this story in Genesis. To save themselves from starvation, the tribe of Jacob, or Israel, immigrates from Canaan down into Egypt. And they go down as invited guests. They're essentially farmers. More specifically, sheep herders. And sheep herders were held in very low esteem in Egyptian culture. So I'm just going to put this as bluntly as I can. They took the jobs no one wanted. And everything worked pretty well until, of course, they didn't. And over time, God's people were systemically enslaved as a labor force. You say, "Well, Pastor, is there a lot of archaeological evidence for this?" No. It is scant. I mean, scant, scant, scant. Solomon scant. All right? Some things in the Bible, we got a lot of archaeology to support. Some things we just don't. That there were ever a ton of Hebrews as a slave force in Egypt, it just isn't there. I posted an article for those of you that are going to Egypt and Israel. If you want to be a part of that, it's called Reverend Shane's 2022 Egypt-Israel Trip. It's a Facebook group. But I posted an article today about the archaeology. It just isn't there. It doesn't support it. But you always got to remember one thing about archaeology. You're always one find away from everything changing. Just one find away from everything changing. Archaeology will run just side by side with the Bible, and then it'll diverge, and it'll come back, and it'll diverge, and it'll come back. The cool thing about the Bible is it never changes. Archaeology will come and go. It'll drift and swerve like a drunk driver. But at the end of the day, the Bible just holds true. And if archaeology is truly searching for truth, there will be a day when archaeology, science, and history, and the Bible all completely line up. It'll be there. It may not be there today. As the story begins, the Israelites have been slaves in Egypt for 400 years, and slavery is all they've ever known. Think about 400 years, longer than Europeans have been in America, all right? So a really long, long time. As their population exploded in accordance with God's promise to Abraham, Pharaoh got nervous. These people seemed a little too blessed. They seemed to be a little too prolific. And Pharaoh sets about to undo what God wants done. He wants to curb the promise made to Abraham. When less extreme measures failed, Pharaoh declares that all Israelite baby boys will be drowned in the Nile. Ironically, Herod is going to make the same proclamation in the birth story of Jesus, that all baby boys around Bethlehem be killed. And ironically, Mary and Joseph and Jesus flee to Egypt. There's irony in this. So, what we have is infanticide. Our text then takes us from the general to the specific, and we end up in the household of a very particular family. The guy's name's Amram. His wife is named Jochebed. So those of you that are expecting children and looking for names, Amram for a boy, Jochebed for a girl. They had two children, a daughter named Miriam, who's a teenager, a young son named Aaron. It's with the birth of their third child that the realm of possibility begins to shift. And it's really based on the courage of a single, completely disenfranchised slave woman. One thing I need you to know is in Egypt, women were held in much higher esteem than they were in much of the Fertile Crescent. And in fact, some lines, family lines, were traced by the mother, not the father, in Egypt. Why? Because you always know who the mother is. They didn't have the Mari Povich show back then to make these kind of things, right? There's no reality TV back then. There's no DNA test. You always know who the mother is. And so in addition to Cleopatra, who's actually Greek, not Egyptian, but in addition to her, there are lots of powerful, powerful Egyptian women. Jochebed's not one of them. She is a Hebrew slave. She is powerless. But we're going to find that Jochebed's utterly incredible. She decides that she is going to say no to Pharaoh. She's a slave woman. Pharaoh has edict that her baby boy is to be drowned in the Nile. And she says no. No. Not going to do it. She will not report the birth to the authorities. She hides the baby for about 3 months. And those of you that's ever tried to take babies into church, you can do it for a while, right? When they're really, really little and they sleep all the time. But after a while, it gets to be impossible. She can't hide the baby anymore. And she knows that if the baby's found, she's going to risk punishment on not only her family, but her people. She's between a rock and a holy place. So she comes up with a plan. Her plan's not a particularly good one, but any plan's better than no plan. All right? Here's the plan. Jochebed is going to make a basket of papyrus reeds. A basket made of papyrus reeds. And then she is going to cover it in pitch so it'll float. And she's going to place it in the backwater vegetation of the Nile near where the noble women bathed. Her daughter Miriam is going to keep an eye on the basket, knowing it's going to be found. If the baby is drowned, Miriam will let the mother know. If the baby is spared, Miriam is to say to the woman who found it, would you like a wet nurse for this child? That's it. That's the plan. So a princess drew Moses out of the water. She actually named him Moses, which means drawn out of the water. Moses is probably found by the daughter of Seti I. We're probably in Memphis, not Elvis's Memphis, but the Memphis in Egypt, all right? So we're probably in ancient Memphis. The daughter of Seti I finds the baby. Ironically, not only does the child survive, Miriam comes up to her and she goes, yeah. So at the end of the day, Jochebed, who took the biggest gamble of her life, ends up getting to be the nurse to her own child. So it's really kind of a beautiful story of courage and restoration, but there is a point at which she's going to have to give him up. And so when he is weaned, Jochebed lets her son go for the second time and sends him not to a basket, hoping he's not drowned, but sends him to the palace to be raised in the house of Pharaoh. Moses is going to Harvard by the Nile. He's going to receive the best education in his world. He's going to learn grammar, history, theology, medicine, arithmetic, astronomy, engineering. He's probably going to learn about warfare. I mean, Moses is going to get the best education in his world. Little does he know, he's being prepared for something still to come. I'm going to stop on this corner and preach a moment. Sometimes we don't always understand what's going on in our life or why we're doing or going through such a thing. But sometimes if we are obeying the pings of God, we need to realize God is preparing us for something to come later. We don't have all the information now, but he's preparing us for something to come later. Chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Up to 40 years have passed. I don't know how old Moses is. He is an adult, and he's probably not just, 21. But years have passed. And it says, Moses saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. Now, Hebrew, we don't know where the word comes from. It can mean to wonder. The etymology is unclear, but they use the word Hebrew and Israelite. Israelite are simply the children of Israel, who is Jacob. Hebrew's a little tougher, and back here, they're actually referred to as Hebrews quite a bit. So Moses sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. He looked this way and that, and he killed the Egyptian. Moses has apparently gained knowledge of his circumstances surrounding his birth. He's also far enough removed from the palace that he can see the oppression of the Israelites. We know that Egyptian taskmasters had long rods that came from Syrian wood, and they were flexible. And we know the taskmasters, when people weren't doing what they want, would smack them with these flexible rods. Unlike a whip, it didn't cut people up. You could keep on working. And so they smack them with these rods. So this guy's getting beaten with a rod. Moses sees it, looks to see if anybody's looking, and he kills the dude. And Moses impulsively acts. Not really, that would be manslaughter. What's the text say he did first? He looked around. Do you realize that takes it from manslaughter to murder too? He didn't wake up that morning looking to kill this guy. That's murder one. But it does take it from manslaughter to murder two. Moses killed the Egyptian and he hid him in the sand. There's a lot of sand. Verses 13, 14. The next day, Moses saw two Hebrews fighting with each other. These are his own people. They're fighting with each other. He gets in and he breaks it up, and one of them says to Moses, "Are you going to kill us like you did the Egyptian?" So clearly the word's out. Somebody found the dude buried in the sand. It's one of the truths about things we bury in the sand. They eventually come out. Sometimes you got to realize your life just can't be the same. It doesn't mean it can't be good, but it can't be the same. And Moses is in a really interesting position here. You see, sometimes when you can't go back, it makes going forward easier. He can't go back. He just can't go back. Verse 15a, when Pharaoh heard, he sought to kill Moses. If Seti the first was the Pharaoh when Moses was found in the basket made of reeds, Ramses the second is the Pharaoh now. And it's a pretty good guess because Ramses is the Pharaoh for 67 years. He is the Pharaoh for a long, long time. He and Moses probably grew up together in the king's palace. They may well have known each other. They may have been friends. They may have been rivals. I don't know. But with this decree, Moses has two choices. He can remain in Egypt and be executed, or he can flee. If he flees, no one will chase him because the Egyptians believe that banishment from Egypt was far worse than death. So he fled. Moses is starting all over. Where does he go? Well, here's where he goes. We are up here. Moses is going to be in this area. He's probably going to grow up right around here. Here is Giza, where the guy on all the MyPillow commercials gets the cotton for his sheets, right? Giza, right there. Boom. And he is down here in Memphis. That is where he would have been as a child. We know that the capital moved during Ramses' tour. But let's just say Moses is in this area, which is going to be right in here. Where does he go? He goes far, far, far away. Chapter 2, verse 15. Moses fled from Pharaoh, then settled in Midian and sat by a well. So he is now in Midian. Can I take a look at that Midian map? I just want to let you see where this is. I think it should be like the next one. I want you to see. There we go. Here is Memphis, okay? Here is where Ramses II built his own capital, and he named it after himself, all right? So Pi Ramses is there. Where does Moses run? Over through the wilderness of Shur, down into the Sinai Peninsula, on the other side of the Gulf. He is way over here in Midian. I mean, he is a long, long, long way away. And he fled to Midian, and he set by a well. Now, rather than be executed, Moses flees eastward. He crosses both the east and the west northerly prongs of the Red Sea, which is territory he will later in his life be back in again. And he settles in Midian. The Midianites are nomads. They're desert people. They descend from Midian, the son of Abraham, and a later wife by the name of Keturah. Bottom line, long way from Egypt. There's no way Moses should ever be found. He should never have to go back. He is getting a do-over. He's starting his life over. Keep in mind, he's been raised as a prince. He's got the best education in his world, and he's wanted. Verse 16 and 17. Reuel, the priest, had seven daughters who came to water their flocks. When shepherds drove the girls away, Moses defended them and watered the flocks. It appears a group of shepherds had this thing going. They would let the seven daughters of Reuel fill up all their water jugs, and then when they got them all filled up, they would run the girls off, and then they would use those to water their own flocks, and then they would make the girls have to fill up all of the jugs again. When Moses saw this injustice, he springs to action, and he does something incredible. He drives away the nefarious shepherds without, drumroll please, killing anyone, which is an improvement. And he gallantly waters the girls' animals. It's kind of like the old, anybody remember Underdog? You know? Yeah, it's kind of like that. Yeah, kind of coming to save the day, right? I like it. Verses 18 and 20. They told their father an Egyptian defended them. And the father said, "And you let him go?" Reuel instantly ascertained a man like this could be useful in his tribe. Reuel is the patriarch of his tribe. He has an extended family living underneath him. And on top of everything else, he has 7 unmarried daughters. And now this stranger shows up and shows that he's brave. He's obviously a good fighter. He would have been taught to do that in Egypt as a prince. And Reuel says, "Guys, girls, let's make sure I'm getting this right. None of you are married. A man stepped in and defended you. He made our enemies step back. He watered my flocks, and you let him get away. Go find him. And bring him here and invite him to supper." So you may say, how did supper go? Verse 21, Moses agreed to stay with the man, married his daughter Zipporah, and they had a son named Gershom. Well, Moses is going to learn to do something now. He's going to learn to live in the desert. This is going to be the second part of his education. And he's going to spend 40 years of his life pretty soon in the desert as a leader of people. He is getting educated right now. Verses 23 through 25. And then Pharaoh died, and Israel groaned under their slavery. And God heard the prayer of his people, remembered his covenant, and took notice. What covenant? It's the covenant made to Abraham. It's a covenant made to Abraham. That covenant runs through the whole of the Old Testament. So Israel has been oppressed for 400 years. They finally cry out to God. Sure makes you wonder what would have happened if they would have cried out sooner. Maybe sometimes we need to get sick and tired of being sick and tired a little sooner. You ever think how much of your life, how much misery you could have spared yourself if you would have cried out to God a little sooner? They cry out to God, and God heard the prayers of his people, and he remembered his covenant. Remember is a word we're going to see over and over in the Old Testament. When God saw the plight of the world in the Noah narrative, God remembered his covenant, and he puts a rainbow. And God, that was a reminder to God. Remember. To dismember is to do what? Tear apart. To remember is to put back together. Think of remember as restoring. Think of remember as being put back together. The people are enslaved. Salvation history is offline. They are dismembered. They cry out to God. God remembers his covenant. They are remembered. We are coming back together now. Moses now has dual degrees, one from Harvard by the Nile and the other from the School of Hard Knocks. And like his ancestor Abraham before him, he's about to have a one-on-one with God. Where is he? Where is he? We're right here in Midian. And let's take a look at our next slide. He's on Mount Sinai. And we'll get back to that in just a few minutes. So, Moses, chapter 3, verse 1. Moses was keeping the flock of Jethro and came to Mount Sinai. You guys do realize we're going to step on Mount Sinai in January 2022. I have some enthusiasm about this. So Moses is keeping the flocks of Jethro. I thought his father-in-law's name was Reuel. Well, decades have passed since we left Moses in Midian. And the first thing we notice is that his father-in-law changed names. What in the world are we supposed to do with this? You're welcome. Regardless, Moses seems content to live out the life of a common man. Any dreams of success or significance are obviously long gone. Moses has to feel like he's made too many mistakes. He shows almost no ambition. And that's really shown by the fact he's watching another man's sheep. He is the smartest guy in Midian. He knows how to do all kinds of stuff. He just doesn't have any ambition around this. He is watching another man's sheep. He's not even the patriarch of his own clan. Verses 2 through 6, an angel appeared to Moses in the form of a bush, blazing but not consumed. What a great metaphor. I just want to suggest to you, we as Christians should be blazing but not consumed. I know a lot of Christians that blaze and then they burn out and then they're all crispy. Right? How many of you have ever gotten crispy in your service to the Lord? Blazing but not consumed. Moses turned aside, and when God called to him, Moses said, "Here I am." Moses isn't running anymore. He's got nowhere to go. Here I am. And God said, "Remove your sandals. You're on holy ground." My best reading of the text suggests strongly in the Hebrew that had Moses not turned from his routine to check out the bush, there would have been no conversation with God. It says, the angel appeared to him in the form of a bush. Moses turned aside when God called to him. There is a New Testament word for that we translate worship. It's called proskuneo. Pros means to turn toward. Cuneo means to offer someone a kiss. Worship is turning from whatever our attention is on to God for the purpose of intimacy in a holy sense. So here, Moses sees a bush, it catches his attention, he turns to it, and God speaks. When Moses turns toward the bush, God initiates a conversation. My friends, I just want to be very clear. Until we turn toward God, a lot of times we're going to miss the conversation. I know a lot of people, they just start coming to church, and they're not sure why. Maybe you're one of them. Maybe you just started to come to church. You're not even sure why. What you're doing here is something inside of you is compelling you to do that. You're turning toward God. And I just want to say, a conversation's coming. A conversation is coming your way. God says, verse 7, "I have heard the cry of my people, and I am coming down to deliver them." God hasn't been down since the Garden of Eden. When he planted it with his own hands, God says, "I'm coming down." It's like your parents when you were a kid being too loud. Your parents were upstairs. "I'm coming down there. I'm coming down to deliver you to a land flowing with milk and honey. Now go. I'll send you to Pharaoh to bring my people out of Egypt." There's only one way the land of Israel is milk and honey. If you're coming out of a straight-up desert. Because let me tell you, folks, it ain't Indiana. Right? It just isn't Indiana. But if you're coming out of a desolate desert, there are green places there. It is a land of milk and honey. The only way it's the land of milk and honey is if you're viewing it and comparing it to sand and rock. And now you know where I got the title for this series. This denotes not only a better land, fertile, more fruitful, plentiful, but it also taps into the promise made to Abraham. Moses now understands that God's call requires him to face his past and to go the one and to return to the one place he's most afraid to go. Sometimes God calls us to do things that don't make sense to us. And sometimes God will ask us to do the last thing we ever wanted to do. I can honestly tell you, when I was 17 years old and you would have said, "What's the last thing you'd ever want to do?" I'd say, "Be a preacher." No joke. My dad was a preacher. It seemed like a pretty crummy way to make a living to me. I saw what he had to deal with. I saw the things around. Last thing in the world I ever wanted to do. God says to Moses, "Captain, you're going to have to go back to the scene of the crime. You're going to have to go back and face Pharaoh." Wow. I know what Moses had to be thinking. Why did I turn toward the bush? right? A little Bob Seger theology. Wish I didn't know now what I didn't know then. Terrible. God says, Moses, you remember your half-brother who wants you dead? Well, he's now the most powerful man in the world. And what I need you to do is go tell him to release all the Hebrew slaves, knowing he'll never do it, and then lead them out of Egypt. You got any questions? Moses had all kinds of questions. I'm just going to hit the highlight. Chapter 4, verse 1 through 2. But suppose they don't believe me. That's a decent question, right? Murderer? Exiled? You know, he has no credibility with the Egyptians. He's a turncoat. He has no credibility with his own people. He's a murderer. He's the worst choice in the whole world. And he says, suppose they don't believe me. And God says, what is in your hand? And Moses said, a staff, a stick, a shepherd's staff. And God said, let this staff remind you that I'm all you need. It's a symbol. It's a symbol that God is all he needs. I love the idea of a shepherd's staff. I love the idea of this. I just think it would have been cool just to have one. Lonnie's got one he carries all the time. I just think it's cool. Man, if you had a shepherd's staff, can you imagine how fast you could make that thing go around? I know if I was in antiquity and I had a shepherd's staff, a lot of sticks, boom, I would have invented baseball. A lot of great things would have happened if I had a shepherd's staff. Moses said, God said, let this remind you that I am all you need. Chapter 4, verses 18. And after Moses makes a lot of excuses, including I don't speak very well, and God says, oh, shut up and go. You're just getting on my last nerve. You're wearing me out, boy. Go. Go to Egypt. So Moses went with the staff of God in his hand. The reminder that God was all that he needed. Well, Moses finally stopped telling God why he couldn't go and what he didn't have. My friends, at what point in our lives do we finally stop telling God why we can't go and what we don't have? Has God pinged you to do something and you've been telling God why you can't go and what you don't have? Well, Moses finally got moving. And guess what he learned to do? He learned to offer God what he did have. These three verses that follow are almost unintelligible in Hebrew. But it's really interesting to me. When Moses finally decides he's going to obey God, everything goes wrong. Everything goes wrong. We call that spiritual warfare. We're learning that on Sundays with our good friend Nehemiah. A lot of times when you say yes to God, everything goes wrong because Satan is attacking. Now, the best I can get out of this almost unintelligible piece is simply this. This is what I think kind of happened here, all right? So, Moses has married Zipporah, the Midianite, the daughter of Reuel and or Jethro. Zipporah was no doubt never on board with this whole idea that Moses is going to leave her, or worse yet, take her and his children all the way to Egypt, where he is a wanted man. Moses is taking her away from her patriarch, her father. He's taking her away from her clan. He's taking her away from the life she knows. He's also doing something else. It's very important in the Old Testament. He's taking her from the desert, which is open and where God is, to the city where all kinds of bad things happen. I'm imagining before the trip started, God told Moses to circumcise his sons. And in the Hebrew, you get a hint of that. And Zipporah would not permit it. So Moses gave in, and he began the trip in disobedience to God. And on the trip, Moses became deadly ill. The text actually says the Lord tried to kill him. And this made Zipporah even more angry. And as Moses lay near death, she angrily circumcises her son, curses Moses by saying, "You are bridegroom of blood to me." She throws the two foreskins at Moses' feet, and he's instantly healed. So how was your day, honey? Wow. The Old Testament's boring, says the person that's never read Genesis or Exodus. The Old Testament's weird. Now we're getting closer. Boring? No, no, no. Verse 29. So now Moses takes the message to the Israelite leaders back in Egypt. And the Israelites believe and they worship God. This is really cool. Remember when Nehemiah went to the people and he cast vision and they rallied around the vision? When the people hear Moses' story, burning bushes and all, and when they hear his prophecy of freedom from captivity, they are thrilled. Why? Because they've been crying out to God. They've finally been groaning under their labor. Moses is the answer to their prayers. He is their potential deliverer, their potential Messiah. With the people behind him, Moses goes out in search of Pharaoh, who's technically still in search of him. We're somewhere around 1260 BC. When Moses steps before the throne of Pharaoh and he speaks the four most powerful words in Exodus, "Let my people go. Let my people go." And at that point, there was no going back. There was a point of no return. History tells us that after the death of his wife, Nefertiti, Ramses the Great, which I think he gave himself that name, Ramses the Great turns his attention from foreign conquest to city building. So he builds a new capital for himself. He is building stuff. He shifts the capital from Memphis to a city he names after himself. And according to the Bible, the Hebrews are his slave labor force. They were good. They were cheap. What are the chances he's going to let his slave labor force go? Zero. And Ramses says to Moses, verse 2 through 5, "Who is the Lord? Who is the Lord? Get back to work." Like Adam and Eve, the serpent, the people in the days of Noah and Babel, Pharaoh questions the authority of God over him. He sticks his finger in the face of God and he says, "Who are you to tell me what to do?" Additionally, he enacts what I will call Operation If They Think They Have It Bad Now. All right? Verse 6 through 9, he says, "Withhold straw, but require the same number of bricks." It appears the Israelites had slowly shifted from free ranchers to enslaved brick manufacturers and masons. And in doing so, they had moved from the freedom of the desert, which good things happen in the Old Testament, to the city where bad things happen. But part of the deal was they had chopped straw brought to them. The Egyptian climate allows straw to be grown all year round. They mixed the straw with clay, and they made the bricks out of it. That was provided for them. Now, Pharaoh says, these people obviously have too much time on their hands. So I'm going to make them chop their own straw, which is going to take a lot of time, and their quota of bricks per day is going to be exactly the same. And so what he's done is created an impossible workload. Pharaoh's not trying to work them, he's trying to break them. And soon their frustration all gets pointed in Moses' direction. "Moses, do you realize ever since you showed up, our lives have been worse, not better?" The literal Hebrew says Moses has brought the Israelites into a bad odor with the Egyptians. We are bad breath to the Egyptians, which is really interesting because the Egyptians are probably the cleanest group of people the world's ever known. They invented things like bathing and soap and combs. And I mean, they're a very clean people. They invented perfume. What they didn't invent, they improved. I mean, this is a very sanitary lot. Did you know the ancient Egyptians even had breath fresheners? They chewed on things. I mean, they're very concerned about not smelling or looking exactly like humans. And so they've got a lot of concern here. But you have brought us, we are bad breath to the Egyptians. And this is all your fault. Moses, all your fault. Verses 22 through 24. So Moses says to God, why in the world did you send me? You've done nothing to deliver your people at all. Nothing. Despite a discouraged leader, salvation history marches on, and a series of 10 plagues breaks out in Egypt. Pharaoh's heart is unmoved. And finally, God has had enough. There is a point at which God has had enough and mandates that the firstborn of the land of Egypt will be killed from the Pharaoh on down by a death angel. What happens next is really astounding because it's applying a spiritual solution to a spiritual problem. And it all has to do with a lamb. Chapter 12, verse 21, Moses told the families to select a lamb. He said, place the blood of the lamb on the doorpost, and it will protect you. What it literally says is the death angel will pass over you. And it's where we get the concept of Passover, and you're going to hear about it for the rest of the Bible. This is where that comes from. Moses' instructions may seem like an odd request, but I need you to hear this. When God makes a command, it must be followed completely to the last detail. And you're going to learn that when you read Leviticus. I mean, it's going to feel like punishment, but you're going to learn that. God is concerned about details. When the death angel came, he would only pass over the homes with doorposts marked by lamb's blood. And here we have a Jesus spotting. In the fullness of time, God's perfect lamb was crucified at Calvary, and the blood that flowed from his hands, feet, and side washes away our sin. And we are saved by the blood of the lamb. Verse 28, the Israelites did as God commanded. So the firstborn of Egypt dies. The firstborn of the Hebrews are spared. Pharaoh breaks. He's lost a firstborn. He breaks. And all of a sudden, he allows the Hebrews to leave Egypt. And according to the biblical narrative, it looks like they may have been hundreds of thousands strong. And then Pharaoh changes his mind. Verse 14. Chapter 14, verse 1. Pharaoh's army approached in the distance. The people began to panic and cry out for God for help. They turned to Moses and complained. So Moses has taken this huge people group out of Egypt into freedom, except they're going the wrong direction. They're not headed up to the promised land. They are headed south. They are going the wrong direction. And not only that, Moses has led them into terrible defensive position. They're up against the Red Sea, and they look up, and all the armies of Pharaoh are coming at them. And of course, everyone blames Moses. Verse 13, Moses told the people to stand where they were and watch the Lord rescue them. I like this. Moses isn't, he's not timid anymore. He's not making excuses anymore. He's just at it. He says, you shut your mouths and watch the Lord rescue you. He looks at his staff and he knows what to do. Verse 21, Moses raised his hand over the sea and the Lord opened a path. And so the people walked across on dry ground. And when the Israelites were on the other side, the Lord told Moses to raise his hand over the sea again, and the water rushed over the Egyptians. The people get delivered. Their shoes aren't even muddy. The stories of God's friends end well in the Old Testament. The stories of God's enemies end poorly. Verses 30 and 31. This is how the Lord rescued Israel on that day. When they saw God's mighty power, they put their faith in him and their servant Moses. Here's what we learn as we wind this down. In the Old Testament, when the odds are right about zero, God's usually just getting started. When the odds are right about zero, God's usually just getting started. And yet the key is the Lord rescued Israel. Moses didn't rescue Israel. The people didn't rescue Israel. The Lord rescued Israel because the Lord is their patriarch. They are now his tribe. He has taken responsibility for them because they were in obedience to him. The Lord rescued the people. And in the aftermath of the miracle, Moses' approval rating is suddenly at an all-time high. And he's ready to take a final step. And he has something he wants to give the people. This is incredible. And then Moses climbed to Mount Sinai to appear before the Lord. And he gave these instructions. And here they are. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Honor your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And you shall not covet. And verse 9 says, God now said that he would come to the people. And Moses prepared them for God's visit by purifying them and having them wash their clothes. What an incredible story. Just an incredible story. In verse 13, now we got to somehow move things forward. We know that God led the people in what I'm going to say is a roundabout way. This is sort of the path that Moses led the people in. Let's just be real honest. If this was your MapQuest, you'd delete the app. But this is what happens. God leads us in a roundabout way. Geometry says the shortest distance between two points is a straight line, but the Hebrews were not ready for geometry. Mainly because the Philistines were in the way. The seafaring Philistines lived on the western Mediterranean coast. They're strong, they're warlike. They produce giants like Goliath of Gath. They are in five federation cities along the coast. This ragamuffin group of refugees would do well to avoid the Philistines. And so they swing to the east and then north, and eventually they're going to enter the promised land through modern Jordan. And then verse 19, and we close with this thought. And Moses took the bones of Joseph. So cool. 400 years earlier, Joseph had died believing that God would someday lead the people back to the land promised to Abraham. And he asked his people, when I die and when you leave and go back to Canaan, take my bones with you. And they took the mummified bones of Joseph to the promised land. I love this. When it was finally time to arrive, they took all traces of the Israelites' presence away from Egypt. Not even Joseph's bones remained in Egypt. So it doesn't surprise me a bit. There's no archaeological evidence of them. So, after 40 years in the wilderness, which is the desert, the children of Abraham are finally ready to enter the promised land. And God takes Moses up on a mountain. This is me standing on Mount Nebo. In Jordan in 2008, God takes Moses to Mount Nebo, and he lets him see the promised land. Moses dies on Mount Nebo, and a general named Joshua moves and leads the people in holy conquest. The tribes are now going to have to take the land, but for salvation history to move forward, they're going to have to become a unified nation, or at least make steps toward it, and it's going to be really jagged. In the meantime, salvation history is going to be entrusted to the hands of some tribal leaders called judges. How do things go? Poorly. Really poorly. And next week, we're going to meet a man named Samson who was the really poorliest of them all.